Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Join us for a journey as we go back to the great civilizations of the past. Who were the people? What were they like? How did they begin? And how did they end? Let's find out on this episode of Fan of History. Hello, Dan.
Hello, Bernie. I'm so excited for this subject. This is such a great topic.
Yes. Not too much death and destruction in this part of it anyway.
On the contrary, there's culture and learning and good things.
Yes. We're going to start talking about some building work at Nineveh, and I'm going to put it at 646. This is really an ongoing thing. Can't really accurately date it all, but let's just say it started here, and then we'll talk about some of the projects.
I think it makes sense that it started in 646 because the big revolution is over, and Ashurbanipal has been receiving a lot of cultural input. Mm-hmm. And I think this is a thought he has been having for a long time, because there is a cultural movement in all lands he touches.
Mm-hmm.
The old cuneiform is going out of style, because cuneiform is super hard. You have to spend your whole life, as Ashurbanipal has done. He was trained to be a scribe.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so hard to learn to read and write. But now we have fancy new stuff. We have Aramaic, a language that is extremely easy to learn, and we have the alphabet.
Mm-hmm.
Phoenician writing is really simple. So people are learning how to write Aramaic in Phoenician letters, which
right.
is super simple. So Ashurbanipal fears that all knowledge will be lost, that all the ancient books people have been writing in cuneiform for God knows how long, and there's so much knowledge, and he sees that in a short while nobody will be able to read this stuff.
Huh.
That's a good act. This is his greatest act, in my opinion.
I mean, we wouldn't know anything about this if he didn't do this.
This is such an important act of his that I'm almost willing to forget all the atrocities in last episode, but not quite.
And I mean, you know.
And he will be doing more atrocities.
Of course, he's got. And you know, some are still. A leopard never changes his spots, right? As they say.
So it's a mass murdering librarian we're talking about here.
Yes, he is. He is. That is for sure.
And of course, we're talking about the library of Ashurbanipal.
Yes. It was started in the 640s as an ongoing project. I mean, all the kings had libraries in their palaces, but he really increased the contents of his, bringing texts from all over the empire.
Yeah, because He is the first king who knows how to read and write. Sennacherib, Sargon, they didn't care about the libraries. They were like weird places for his scribes to hang out in.
Right.
But Ashurbanipal understands what's in the libraries.
You know, some say that he was looking for magic, a lot of magic, too, because a lot of the stuff that they find are spells and things like that. So maybe trying to, you know, figure out how to keep on the power, keep power and different magic things and stuff like that. There are, of course, there are historical works and there's all kind of things in there.
He is a librarian, not a scientist. So, of course, he's looking for magic.
Right.
The Assyrians are, after all, quite superstitious.
Yes. I mean, everybody was in those days. They didn't really have... How would you know what all that stuff was? I mean, how would you know that a star was a sun?
Exactly.
I mean, how could you... That's not, you know, intuitive. Oh, that must be a giant burning sun.
And of course, Ashurbanipal will brag about his ability to read and write.
Yes, he does.
So this is what he says. I acquired the hidden treasure of all scribal knowledge, the science of heaven and earth, and I have studied the heavens with the learned masters of oil divination. What? I have solved the laborious problems of division and multiplication, which were not clear. I have read the artistic script of Sumer and the obscure Akkadian, which is hard to master, taking pleasures in the reading of the stones from before the flood. So I think here, except for his knowledge of strange language, he basically has the education of a fourth grader. He can do division and multiplication, which probably makes him one of the most learned men in the whole Near East.
Right.
He's very proud of this accomplishment.
Oh, yeah, I mean, yeah, for sure. It's funny with the oil divination. That's, I just realized when I was a kid, my mother, and so then my aunt, so that would be my great aunt, she used to do, my mother had a headache, so we were Italian Catholics. She used to get something with oil and some water, and she would drop the oil in it, and if the oil ran a certain way in the bowl, it meant that she had the overlook and somebody was jealous of her.
Okay.
I'm telling you, as I got older, I'm like, what the hell are you guys doing? But I'm telling you, man, they believed it. So it's a human nature thing, I guess.
I bet.
I think we still want to do a whole episode sometime on the library, right? But maybe we can give you some of the highlights.
Yes. It's given what will happen in 612 BC, it is such a miracle that this library actually survived. Because almost nothing of the Assyrian Empire survived.
I know.
But this did. And we found the library of Ashurbanipal in the 1850s and spent 80 years digging it up.
Yeah. It's a great story.
Yeah, this is how we discovered the Epic of Gilgamesh.
Yeah.
The very first fictional work preserved. Mm-hmm. The oldest fictional work preserved. I've done a couple of videos on the Epic of Gilgamesh on the Fan of History YouTube channel. And actually in Hillary Clinton's emails, there was a mention of the Epic of Gilgamesh.
No way.
So a lot of people... were searching on YouTube for the Epic of Gilgamesh, and I made a video named "The Epic of Gilgamesh in 5 minutes." So a lot of people looked at that. So it is quickly becoming the most popular video on our YouTube channel.
That's amazing. Put Hillary Clinton in the tags. Oh my God.
Yeah, I think I haven't read the email, so I won't speculate on what they were about. But I was surprised that the Epic of Gilgamesh was mentioned.
I have a feeling, I'm just going to throw this out, that I doubt that the Trump campaign is referencing the Epic of Gilgamesh in any of their emails.
I think Trump would very much enjoy being like Gilgamesh.
Yeah. Who was the other guy? What was the barbarian? What was his name?
The Wild Man. Yeah. Enkidu.
Hey, Enkidu. Enkidu.
Yes. Yeah, we also have...
Oh, sorry.
Go ahead.
No, you tell me.
We also have the Enuma Elish, which we have referenced before, the Babylonian creation myth. There is also the Poor Man of Nippur, which is a strange tale about a man who beats up the mayor of his town 3 times for laughing at him over a goat.
It's true.
And as you mentioned, the historical and literary texts, actually those things we are really interested in, make up less than 2% of Ashurbanipal's collection. The rest of it is divination texts, legal stuff, which of course can be interesting, and administrative reports. Remember that after Sargon, there is a lot of writing, and after the post office was invented in Assyria, there is a lot of letters, there is a lot of writing. Yeah. You actually have quite a bit of Assyrian writing after Tiglath-Pileser III.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
You know what's cool too? I remember that they in the library, they said that the different texts are in different shapes. So certain ones are on circles, some of them are squares, some of them are rectangles. You know, that's how they could tell, like, a, for example, like a legal text might be on a circle, a, you know, round clay tablet.
Okay.
Yeah, that kind of thing. I also heard that Ashurbanipal had a shopping list of what he's looking for. So it was all, you know, many years during his reign, he's looking for things. And he sent scribes and messengers to acquire things, to copy them. And it's also been said that there was Babylonian scribes literally chained up in Nineveh to write from memory.
Yeah, I expect that all Assyrian soldiers have had like orders to do this, to find scribes, find texts, mm-hmm. check with the scribes, is this interesting? And possibly they were even rewarded for finding books or texts.
Yeah,
there are, of course, no books at this time.
And just to break to throw in Anne Rice, the Servant of the Bones, there was a character who went all over the Near East looking for scrolls and scripts and things so that he could find spells, and then that's how he cast his spell. So,
throw that the Ashurbanipal script police looking for text.
Yeah. He didn't get to it, though. This in the book, it happened later. Anyway.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's the starting of the library. So he also remodeled his called the Bit Reduti, which is means the place of retiring. It is his private apartment in the palace. It wasn't like an apartment we'd consider an apartment. It was his private area of the palace. It originally was built by Sennacherib, so he thinks it was in need of some repairs and updates.
I will now put the sign on my apartment saying Bit Reduti.
Yeah, you should, because it really means the harem.
Oh, good.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, so I know I'd love to see, like, the before and after show, right? Like, here's his Bit Reduti before, And it was built in the 80s, the 680s, by Sennacherib. It was a little dated, so he had to redo it.
I actually do expect Sennacherib's decorating to be better than Ashurbanipal's.
Yeah, I mean, he was an engineer, right?
Yes, and he sort of had a sense for beauty, whereas Ashurbanipal only loves texts and mass murder.
Yeah, so it seems. He talks about how as a king he received so many wonderful messages of his victories over his enemies and had sweet dreams in his bed.
Psychopath.
Totally. He's a total psychopath. On Elamite wagons he brought in bricks, and he made the kings of Assyria do, I'm not sorry, he made the kings of Arabia do manual labor. The kings of Arabia who had violated the oath sworn to me, whom I had taken alive in the midst of battle with my own hands, I made carry the basket and head pad and do task work, molding its bricks, performing labor upon it. They passed their days to the accompaniment of music. Amidst gladness and rejoicing, I completed it from its foundation to its top. I made it wider than it was before. I carried out the work on a magnificent scale.
He's really taking care to make everyone hate the Assyrians.
I know.
This will not end well.
I mean, really. I guess, I don't know. I mean, if people trying to kill you and being in that, having that much power, just goes to their heads. King Joffrey is all I could think of is like King Joffrey.
He seems to be a bit like King Joffrey.
Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe, you know, he lived longer. He's older at this time, too, so... He's more capable King Joffrey.
This is all it takes to wreck a dynasty that is over 1,000 years old, or at least that's what they claimed. One bad seed,
yeah.
One bad guy, and
yeah.
It all goes tumbling down.
Yeah, and definitely a part of it. He says also that... He said he had great beams of cedar from Lebanon, dora leaves of juniper, which he says their odor was pleasant, bound with copper, tall columns enclosed with sheets of bronze, all new furniture, and the final touch, a great park of all kinds of fruit trees I planted at its sides. So like it had a garden inside of it, which is interesting because I remember watching a documentary about the Garden of Eden in the Bible, and so she said that could represent a king's garden where the people could walk with the king because the kings would have these, you know, beautiful gardens inside their palaces. So I definitely. And so this is also where Tumen's head would have been hung in that garden.
Not such a downer. You're walking around in a garden with all the beautiful fruit trees and then a head.
You guys have Halloween? Do you guys celebrate Halloween in Sweden?
Yes, we do. We have imported it from you, and just it's fairly new, actually. We didn't do it when I was a child, but nowadays we do.
Oh, gotcha. Yeah, this would seem like one of those, like a Halloween place, you know, where you're just, oh, there's nice trees, and then, there's a head hanging.
Yes.
Oh, here's where we flay the people over in this area. Oh, Lordy.
Oh, Ashurbanipal, you're ruining it.
Yeah, I know. Oh, here's where we let the blood flow down into the drains. God. Well, that brings us to this wonderful piece of artwork, which is called the Garden Party. And it's a well-known piece of, you know, artwork, ancient artwork. It's a relief. And I found this paper by a scholar. Her name is Alessandra Gilibert, and she wrote a really good paper on this. And Caitlin, our intern, she really helped me with this one too, because this paper had been in my radar for a long time. So I'm glad we got to go through it. I'll post a picture of it. You can see the picture there.
I see the picture.
Yeah. So you see Ashurbanipal. He's laying back on his chair. This must be his garden, you know, that he built in his harem there.
Is looking at the Tumen's head.
And right, he has Tumen's head. It's in the British Museum right now. It's considered a masterpiece. But most people don't recognize all the symbolism that's packed into it. So now our fan of history listeners are going to find out what it's all about. Can I read the description from the website? Because I think it's funny. It's like it's written as it's, oh, it's a beautiful piece of artwork. Gypsum wall panel, relief fragment, carved in low relief. The topmost register is represented by the garden scene with birds and a locust in the trees. Two women holding napkins, fanning the queen with fly whisks. They each bring a dish, which they protect with a fly whisk, towards the enthroned queen and recycling king, who feast in the arbor amid the vines, conifers, and palms, hung with the grisly trophies of victory, consisting of the head and hand holding a wand of Tumen, king of Elam. The hands of a woman drummer and a woman harpist can be seen amid the palms and conifers. Behind the king stand two more ladies holding napkins and fanning him, and behind them is a table holding his sword, bow, and quiver. The furniture is very elaborate.
Why is there locust in the trees?
That symbolizes, I believe, and I didn't put it in the script, but that would symbolize how his troops swarmed like locusts across Elam.
Oh, yeah. Makes sense.
Because let's break it down here a little, right? So people who saw this would have been educated, and the more educated they were, they would have got the symbolism in it. And this was located in a private wing of Ashurbanipal's north palace, so this would have been in line with the high level of comprehension. So that would, you know, means the audience was familiar with all the court literature, like the stuff that he's writing in these cylinders, and this is sort of the picture of it. So like what you said with the locust, and here's another good example. There's an eagle flying over the scene, and this is a representation of something in those inscriptions concerning the Battle of Tiltuba, where he says, "Into the midst of those which none of the kings my fathers had ever approached, my warriors flew like birds." Because, you know, Elam was mountainous. Now, here's the best. This is worth reading through the whole paper. This is a gem. We found one of Tumen's insults. And he says, on the insult, these are the insults he was sending to Ashurbanipal. "I will not sleep until I have come and dined in the center of Nineveh." So this is what Tumen was, you know, one of the insults he had sent to Ashurbanipal. So now do you get the point of this whole garden party?
Yeah, now he is dining in the center of Nineveh. Or his head is some sort of bizarre.
Right. I mean, he is such a gangster. He is. He says, "Oh, you want to dine in Nineveh? You'll dine in Nineveh." So he hung his head and drew a thing of it.
Well,
so, you know, she basically says, you know, Tumen's the garden party. It can be seen as Tumen's Last Supper. That's the name of her title of her paper. Tumen's Last Supper. So, a learned person would have known that. The cruel afterlife that Ashurbanipal had inflicted on Tumen by not allowing him to be buried. Rather, he's paraded around as a mutilated trophy.
Wow.
Right? So here's a couple of things she also points out. Tumen did not respect the omens from the gods, so Tumen's left eye is closed, signifying Tumen's evil eye. Because he mentions Tumen's evil eye. Quote, "While the deformed eye refers to the king's arrogant ignorance of divine signs, the receding hairline and shaggy hairs are grotesque physiognomic indexes of a vile and wicked personality." So even the head that he shows it, like he's ugly, as his eyes closed, he's got wisps of hair hanging off of him. So like Tumen, he's referred to as an exact copy of an evil demon, while Ashurbanipal is radiant. So that's how the relief shows them, how, you know, he's evil and Ashurbanipal is wonderful. So from a pictorial point of view, the garden party adds a touch of black humor. Tumen, forever deprived of sleep, food, and drink, is forced to witness Ashurbanipal's lavish banquet.
Wow.
You know what that reminds me of?
No.
Lily's song, Sour Grapes.
Oh, yes.
Right?
Great song.
So he's used to be a boss, but now he's a follower. And he's eating, probably saying, I bet those grapes are sour anyway. Oh, boy. Asher Banipal, he is a gangster.
He also used an oracle as an excuse for not going into battle himself. Mm-hmm. So Asher Banipal wanted to promote the image of himself as someone who were listening to divine orders.
Yes.
And thus he could keep himself away from harm and not die like Sargon, who was always at the head of his army.
Right. I guess Asher Banipal was kind of a good marketer.
Yeah, I wonder how he got away with that, because the Assyrian kings had been very present on battlefields before.
Yes, there is. There's a letter from, it's one of Bil Ibni's letter, and he says something like, you know, you don't have to, you know, be in the battle. Let your generals, he does say, let your generals do it like your fathers before you. But I, you know, we know that the other kings went to battle, but I imagine they weren't, a lot of them, except for Sargon, you know, charging into the fight.
At least they were promoting themselves as always being there.
Yes. In the Rasam Cylinder, Asher Banipal makes it as if he's there. I did this, I did that. Even says, I did it with my own hands. But we all know that he did not go.
Okay, let's leave the Assyrians for a bit then.
Yeah. Where are we going to go?
To China.
Yes. You do this, because these pronunciations, oof.
I don't have a great track record of pronouncing Chinese.
Well, you're better than me.
I will try.
Okay.
So we are in 645 BC.
Yes.
And we are looking at the Battle of Lulin. The Battle of Lulin was fought between the states of Chu and Xu, with Xu being supported by a coalition of northern states led by Qi. Remember, Qi is the hegemon ruled by Duke Huan and his advisor Gongshong. We did cover these guys. This is the guy that fought the bear and faked his death by biting his lip, and his advisor that almost got pickled. This was back in the 660s, right?
The 680s was when he almost got pickled, and then Guanzong. Then we did cover Guanzong in the 660s.
Okay, they're still around.
Yes.
Xu, that's X-U. Originally, the most powerful state of the Huai River Valley had been weakened by internal unrest and several wars since the beginning of the spring and autumn period. As its influence over eastern Hubei, southern Henan, and central Anhui waned, Xu began to expand into these regions. Threatened by these developments, Xu joined an alliance of several northern states against Xu, led by Argai, Duke Huan of Qi. So we have the alliance against Xu.
Right.
Just before the war, the situation of the Northern Alliance was already showing signs of trouble. Its strongest member state, Qi, had lost much of its military power and influence during the preceding years. And if the Gongyang Xuan is to be believed, there had even been a war among the alliance members directly before the outbreak of hostilities with Chu.
People just can't get along.
So the Northern Alliance doesn't get going. And then in the spring of 645 BC, Chu invaded Xu. So Xu decides to take the initiative here.
Mm-hmm.
And in response to this offensive, Duke Huan of Qi has a meeting with the rulers of Lu, Song, Qian, Bei, Sheng, Cao, and Xu. Near present day Liaoxing. To make plans and sort of see that everyone is on board. And they organize an army to face this threat from Chu.
Mm-hmm.
And they meet up with Chu's army at Lulin, this battle. And it doesn't go very well for the northerners. They are defeated, marking the beginning of Xu's final decline and accelerating the end of Qi's hegemony over China. Remember, the spring and autumn period is the period of the hegemons, that the emperor himself, or the king, doesn't have much power at all.
Right.
In autumn, armies from Qi and Cao also invaded the state of Li in present-day Suzhou. In attacking Li, a vassal state of Shu, they attempted to create a diversion in favor of Xu. However, Qiu forces remained active in Xu, while tension among the coalition began to rise. The following winter, these tensions escalated as Song invaded Cao, even though the two were still part of the alliance. Oh, that's not good.
I know.
And that, of course, undermined the relief expedition and showcased that Qi had lost control over the alliance members. As the coalition fell apart, Xu finally confronted the Xu forces at Lulin. And very little is known about the battle itself, beside the fact that the alliance lost pretty bad. Xu defeated the Xu army. The Chu Chuan only comments that Xu was defeated because it relied too heavily on its allies' support. Xu's victory was apparently not total, as Xu remained independent and allied with Qi for the time being. So while the Battle of Lulin was not responsible for the end of Qi's hegemony and Xu's decline, it sort of helped. So the downfall was going on. The infighting among the Northern Alliance showed that Duke Huan had no longer control of the other states, further reducing his prestige and authority. And to make matters worse, his advisor, Guangxiong, died in 645. And hopefully he wasn't pickled as a burial thing.
No, we have a moment of silence for him. He was from our first podcast that I was in.
So rest in peace.
Rest in peace, Guangxiong. Very wise man. He did not get pickled. Remember, he did the salt and the iron. He's that guy.
Yeah, I remember.
Yeah.
And then we have a very exact date for an event in China. December 24th, Christmas Eve, in 645 BC. Five meteors fell in the north of Shanxi County, Henan Province. How do we know the date so exactly?
It was written in the spring and autumn annals. It's the date they put it in. They wrote the date that it was in there.
They were writing in the spring of 644, so they would probably get the date right.
Yeah.
I was thinking, as a fan of astronomy as well, that maybe this was part of some sort of recurring meteor shower that you could actually track astronomical.
I think you guys should check it out. I think we're going to find out. I think we have meteors in the Rome as well, but that's mystical.
The spring and autumn annals are general history covering 722 to 468 BC, and that has given the name to this period.
Right.
I asked, it's such a poetic name.
It is.
The spring and autumn period. Like, there were no summers and winters, only springs and autumns.
The middle, yeah. It's always like I guess that's sort of like the in-between seasons, right?
Yeah, and Confucius himself, how do you say it in English?
Confucius.
Yeah, he had a hand in editing the annals.
Yeah,
he has a hand in everything.
Yeah, Confucius say.
Everything is written mostly in one-liners in the annals.
Yeah.
I guess they come down to us fully intact, right?
Yeah. I'm not sure how many times they were edited. It's so difficult to get, for me anyway, get a lot of Chinese history because so much of it is, unless you've written in Chinese. Even like YouTube videos and things, which sometimes are helpful when I'm done reading, but not much.
Oh, if somebody knows a lot about Chinese history of this age, then please contact us.
Yeah.
Because we would like to know more.
Yes. We may even have another person helping us with that, too.
Oh, sounds good.
Yeah. We're on a roll.
Great. Shout out to your interns.
Yeah.
To our interns.
Yes, you guys are awesome. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. So let's leave China.
Yes.
And go back to Conan.
Yeah, we'll go right back to Conan.
So what's Conan up to?
Conan, he's stealing women from the woods and, playing with his sword. So the Cimmerians, now we're going to the area of Lydia, and now we're back to Gyges. Remember in the 650s, I said that the rumor of Gyges' demise was greatly exaggerated. And you'll still see today, you'll see in articles and things, they'll say, Gyges died in 652, but don't believe it. because Herodotus put it there. And we know what some people call Herodotus, right?
He gets a lot of bad rap. He's called the father of lies.
Yes.
But I think we will talk so much about Herodotus when he shows up. But I think he was trying to do something that nobody had done before. And he was quite easily impressed. And he didn't know how to fact check. And some things just became very, very wrong.
Yeah. But it's good that he wrote it down. If we didn't have it, we wouldn't even have that. And the stories are great. So, and they're surely based in some sort of fact. So, yeah, anyway, Gyges, he's dealing with the nasty Sumerians on his border. And there's apparently quite a storm brewing in the steppes and to the north, east, and the west of the Assyrian heartland.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. This guy's name, he's got a couple names, too. Herodotus calls him Lygdamus. So you'll see that name, Lygdamus. But Ashurbanipal called him Tugdami or Dugdami. Maybe we'll call him Doug. So it's either Tugdami or Dugdami. He's a demon Galu, a barbarian destructor, spawn of Tiamat. So that's
how... He's a Cimmerian then, or...
Yeah, he's a Cimmerian.
Yes. What's a demon Galu?
I'm glad you asked. It's one of the seven demons who love to eat human flesh. So he calls them a demon. And the Cimmerians and the Scythians are said to be cannibals. I also remember that they use cannabis. So they're like pot-smoking demon cannibals from the steppes.
Oh, my God. I think there is also significant Scythian pressure on the Cimmerians. Of course, this is extremely hard to reconstruct, as they are not historical civilizations. That is that they don't have any written records of what they were up to.
You're exactly right. We don't know exactly what's happening. It seems like to be a pattern, you know, that there's one fiercer tribe pushing another fierce tribe towards them. But, you know, then some of them unite. We're not sure because Dugdami is called King of the World in some inscriptions. That means that he wasn't just a minor Cimmerian chieftain, that he was some sort of a king. You know, kind of almost on the level of Ashurbanipal. You know, king of the universe, maybe Ashurbanipal, but king of the world, meaning, you know, he wasn't just a minor figure. So he may have united some tribes, maybe just a lot of Cimmerians. Like you say, the Scythians may have been pushing them. It's hard to say.
But I think perhaps Archaeogenesis can help us here, or maybe it already has.
What was that?
Archaeogenesis, the DNA work being done
in
the last few years.
Yeah, could
see
be.
What if there was a difference between the Cimmerians and the Scythians, or if this was just what the Assyrians said.
Yeah, right. They were probably pretty close. I remember reading something. You know, I remember things and I forget a lot, but I remember certain things. I remember they did some genetic stuff on the Huns during the Roman times, and they found that there was a lot of mix, like Roman and Hunnish. So like when these people start coming around the borders of the empire, even they started to mix. So
and the great mystery of the Huns is what happened to them when Attila died, but that's another story.
It just that is definitely we'll see if we can get with our interns, we might get to that.
And I think we'll have to give some credit to Lydia and possibly to Urartu as well, because they are keeping the steppe hordes from Mesopotamia.
Absolutely they are, because they may come into Mesopotamia later in the, not in these years, but in the future.
Quite soon, I hear.
I believe so. So, yeah, these guys are moving against Lydia again. So, remember, Gyges was fighting them before. Remember, he brought a couple of chieftains to Ashurbanipal. And then in 644, Gyges' capital of Sardis was attacked by the Cimmerians, and he's killed.
Hmm.
So, moment of silence.
Moment of silence.
Yes. Alas, poor Gyges, I knew him well. He was also our first podcast, the 680s, together.
And here, the people of Mesopotamia, the Chaldeans, the Babylonians, the Elamites, the Assyrians, their world wasn't that bad. They had to have this great war in the 640s. for dynastic reasons, for like too much Assyrian tribute, for kind of reasons. But if they had not had this war, their situation wouldn't be that bad.
Yeah.
This is the real threat. The barbarian hordes of the north.
Mm-hmm.
And poor Lydia has to fight them on their own.
Mm-hmm. What does that remind you of in Game of Thrones? Holy cow.
Yeah, so Lydia is like the Night's Watch.
Yeah, right. I tell you, like, we could have wrote the Game of Thrones. The Game of Thrones is history, right?
No.
So, yeah, guy just dies at the hands of the Cimmerians, the flesh-eating demon king. And so Gyges' son Ardys becomes king of Lydia. So, yeah, the main reason I believe, and you could believe me, that Gyges is not dead in 652 is he's mentioned in tablets and cylinders going back to the 650s and into the 640s, too. And each time, he's not dead. Remember the dream, the rider, blah, blah, blah? But then in the Rassom cylinder, the last one, that's dated 642, you know, at the latest. Okay, latest and earlier strong when I come to the BC times. It could have been written in the 630s. So anyway, he definitely wasn't dead in the 650s if, you know, he's not dead until the thing is written in the 640s.
All right.
So in that, Ashurbanipal tells us Ardys sent the messenger. He agreed to draw the yoke, kiss his feet, and all that other stuff.
I bet he did, because he needs the Assyrian army in the north.
Yeah.
The Assyrian army is still the best army in the world.
Yeah.
That's what you need to keep the hordes back.
I would think. And we don't know what happens for sure. We know that that he captures some Ionian Greek cities. The Cimmerians do.
The Demon King.
Yeah, the Demon King. He captures some of those Ionian Greek cities there in Anatolia. And then it looks like the Assyrians and him almost come to blows, but then they didn't. Doug here, he sent a tribute. He sends tribute, but he didn't swear an Adu. That's a special oath that the Assyrians call. He says, you know, he gave tribute, but he didn't swear the Adu. And what Ashurbanipal writes is interesting. Oh, you read it. You read Ashurbanipal good.
As for Togdami, the king of the mountain dwellers, the presumptuous Gusian who does not know how to revere the gods, he trusted in his own strength and then mustered his troops and set up his camp on the territory of Assyria to wage battle and war. The deities Ashur, Mulisu, Bel-Marduk, Nabu, and Ishtar, who resides in the city Arbela, became furious at his provocative mouth, and it sickened them. By the command of their great divinity, fire fell from the sky and buried him, his troops, and his camp. Togdami became frightened and distressed, and he withdrew his troops and his camp and returned back to his land. Right. What's going on here?
I don't know. No, you don't know. You know, it's possible that he didn't have the Scythians. Or maybe this, you know, maybe the Ashurbanipal made a deal with the Scythians to go after them. It doesn't really make sense. Something
maybe
happened.
More meteors.
Meteors, yeah, meteors. Maybe the gods did do. So, like a little bit later, he changed his mind and he starts to threaten them again. And I'll let you also say what he says. This is basically all the information we have is from Ashurbanipal, and this is what we have.
Okay, so Ashurbanipal talks against Togdami again.
Again.
He broke the vows sworn by the great gods. He transgressed the limits set by them and plotted evil deeds against the territory of Assyria, where flax grows. He sinned by establishing himself on the territory of Assyria. The awe-inspiring brilliance of the weapons of the god Ashur, my lord, overwhelmed him. He went into a frenzy and tried biting off his hands during a loss of all reason. Half of his body was stricken with palsy, and a piercing pain was lodged in his heart. His tongue was scratched, and his penis was claw and was tombed. His life ended, though dissolving and melting like a wax figurine, saying, woe, alas, in their own terror. They struck each other down with the sword. thereby singing the praise of the god Usher, the great lord, my lord. It seems like Dugdami was on a roll here, but then he was beaten by magic.
Yeah, pretty much. Pretty much. That's all I can get.
To quote another famous Cimmerian, what good is a sword against sorcery?
There you go. There you have it.
It's sad that we have these weird speeches of Usher Bunnipal, because something obviously happened here.
Something obviously happened. I mean, there's some scholarship they talk, and it's, you know, a pain lodged in his heart. Maybe he was struck with an arrow. I mean, I don't know. His life dissolving, went melting like wax. He became impotent somehow. I mean,
but Usher Bunnipal is, when he's describing other violence, he's quite accurate, isn't it?
Yeah, so it doesn't sound like the Assyrians did anything. Like, it seems like maybe they had a fight, you know, maybe he sent the Scythians after them, they had a fight. Strabo, he says, Lygdamus, however, at the head of his own soldiers, marched as far as Lydia and Ionia and captured Sardis, but lost his life in Cilicia. So maybe he just died fighting. Maybe the Greeks killed him.
Maybe there was a plague of some sort.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because it seems like he was fairly sick.
Yeah, it was. It was. I mean, it's very biblical, isn't it?
Yeah, but it seems that Ashurbanipal perceived a real threat and real transgression against the oaths, but then nothing of our usual, but I went there with my army and blah, blah, blah. But these weird supernatural events.
Yeah. So, in my opinion, the Assyrians didn't do anything, you know, with their army, and somehow they just got lucky, and I guess the magic was
something. The Dugdami was attacking Ionian Greek cities.
Yeah.
So maybe it was the Greeks.
Yeah.
And of course, Ashurbanipal doesn't care about the Greeks, so no. If they did it, he would rather ascribe it to the gods.
Of course. And he wasn't there anyway, so, you know, he could have been people telling him, oh, yes, my lord, it was the gods who love you so much, you know. Just keep eating your grapes and looking at your dead heads. We got it under control. They're like, whew. A lot of spy work, probably, you know?
And of course, the Cimmerians are not a sexy enemy. If you conquer Elam and wipe out their cities, you retrieve the gods, you destroy the tombs. If you go into the mountains and fight the Cimmerians, you gain nothing except that the stuff that they might have stolen from the Lydians. But they don't have anything. They are refugees in the mountains.
It's a real good point. I mean, you need to. It's like the free people up the north, right? And the White Walkers. I mean, you don't get anything by defeating them, but you can't let them take over.
Exactly.
Amazing. It's a story of history. People come from the steppes and then just whoosh.
And sometimes they do well and sometimes not.
Yeah.
Remember the Kassites?
I don't remember them, but.
The Kassites did conquer Babylonia before we started this podcast, before 1000 BC. But I mentioned them a lot of times, that they were still a presence in Babylonia, but now they are not mentioned anymore. So.
They're probably all, you know, merged together. Well, that's what a Gutian is, too. Gutians came from the mountains, and they had, you know, did the same thing, you know, thousands of years before. Sort of an old term, Gutian.
Yeah, it shows you how little Ashurbanipal knows about these people, as he calls them Gutians.
Yes, it might also be like a slur to call them a Gutian. Like today, you'd say, oh, that guy's such a Philistine, you know, that kind of thing.
Or Vandal.
Exactly. It's like calling him a barbarian. It's basically a Gutian now. It means like a mountain barbarian, troll or something.
And the Cimmerians don't even belong in the mountains.
No, not at all.
They just ended up there.
Yeah. Well, I guess that'll end this episode, and we're going to get back to some more fighting the next time.
Yeah, Ashurbanipal is not done.
No, he is not done.
Remember what Ashurnasipal II did?
Remind me.
He actually beat everyone.
Yeah.
And spent the last years of his life in peace. But Ashurbanipal has a lot of people that don't agree with him.
Yeah, he still has to fight. Maybe he spends his last years in peace. We don't know. We'll find out.
Will we?
I mean, I don't know. It's so crazy how I literally like get into it in this, and I don't really know what's going on in the 630s yet. It's almost like I don't want to spoil it because that gets me into the time. But I know some about it.
that's probably wise.
Yeah.
I'd like to remind our listeners that we do have a Patreon, and that enables us to make these episodes. So if you really enjoy what we do, please go to patreon.com and search for Fan of History, where you can contribute whatever you want to for each episode. So check that out.
Yes, please. And iTunes, and give us a review. That would be great, too. All right, well, we'll come back, and we're going to talk about some more battles.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider supporting us on Patreon, patreon.com/fanofhistory. Just a dollar an episode would help us out. Thanks, and see you next time.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.